to the best of the church's music for the season of Lent at LutheranPublicRadio.org. Sacred music for the season of Lent, LutheranPublicRadio.org.
On the very heels of the latest revelations about the global sexual abuse scandal that is rocking the Roman Catholic world, there comes, smaller but still in the U.S., a very significant story from the Houston Chronicle recently revealed the magnitude of the sexual abuse scandal in the largest Protestant denomination in the U.S., the Southern Baptist Convention, and it rocks that denomination as well. So how do we explain this, that a church with a very hierarchical polity that is used to cover up sexual abuse, like the Roman Catholic Church, can have similar problems to a church like the Southern Baptist Convention that has about the loosest polity a church or a denomination can have and still remain, in some sense, a communion or a denomination? How do we explain that? And what factors went into the now decades-long ignorance of or ignoring of the problem in the Southern Baptist Convention? We're going to be answering those questions for the next hour or so of Issues Etc. Joining us to do so, Dr. Keith Whitfield. He's Associate Professor of Theology, Dean of Graduate Studies, and Vice President for Academic Administration at Southeastern Baptist Theological Seminary in Wake Forest, North Carolina. He's author of a recent column for First Things titled Sex Abuse Among Southern Baptists. Dr. Whitfield, welcome to Issues Etc.
Thank you. It's good to be with you.
You have written, the SBC faces a moral crisis as big, if not bigger, than the theological crisis we faced over the battle for the Bible in the 70s and 80s. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, you know, that statement's an interesting statement, isn't it? I'm glad you gave me a chance to articulate kind of what we're after there. There are different categories of issues. And at the time and place in the 70s and 80s, that was obviously a huge issue for us to have a course correction theologically, particularly for us to articulate what we believe about the Scriptures. You know, I think the reality is making that course of correction was difficult, and it took a lot of time, but we knew what we needed to do. We needed to get people in leadership positions who could clearly articulate a view of Scripture that we felt like was most faithful to Scripture, and that was the doctrine of inerrancy. So it was clear what you needed to do. Here, it's different, and I think that's the reason it's bigger. Is because now we're talking about the way people live their lives in accordance with the Scriptures teach. Decisions that we make together as a body, ethically and morally, and helping us to see things more alike, so that we live a life that's faithful to the gospel that we claim. And I think it's big because the reality is we're a body of people, and we all see things slightly different. In terms of how to navigate some of these things, all of us decry abuse, of course, but how to handle these things, and because bodies of people have a culture of how we handle things, and that culture gets compounded over time, and patterns of thinking and patterns of behavior get compounded. No one wants to be complicit on this thing, but the reality is we have practices that have not helped us deal with these things as decisively as we need to. And uncovering those practices and correcting a culture with a body of churches that are largely autonomous makes this a much messier and much more difficult challenge. So that's kind of what I was getting at there. And I think in our context right now, in terms of a faithful witness to the gospel, in this particular context, this is maybe bigger than the battle for the Bible in the 70s or 80s, and that's sort of what I was trying to get at.
So if you would, give us a brief history of both the abuse and the failure to address that problem in the Southern Baptist Convention.
Yeah, you know, the reality is we're not that different than other bodies of churches. This is, you know, anytime you have people together, you're going to have sinful people, and you're going to have opportunities for people who want to do harm to others to come into those bodies of people. So we're, in some ways, we're not that different than other people. And the reality is we've known of stories for years, stories of abuse in Southern Baptist churches for decades. I wrote another article a couple of days after the First Things article in one of our Baptist publications, local or state Baptist paper, sort of where do we go from here? And Malcolm Yarnell, theology professor at Southwestern Seminary, shared in that article that we co-authored together that his mother, who is, you know, 80 years old, was abused in a local church when she was a little girl. So, you know, these are the types of stories that have been uncovered over the last few weeks, stories that we've known about even before the last couple of weeks. So we've known about these things for a long time. And we can track back to the 80s and the 90s when groups like the Christian Leadership Commission or state conventions were trying to educate churches on this issue. Now, we can look at those and see, we can see pockets of conversation. It wasn't a huge push in those times, but we recognized that there was a problem. We recognized that we needed to train people to handle them appropriately. But then in the early 2000s, abuse survivors began to speak up in the media, and some issues began to emerge. In 2004, a motion was made in the floor of the Southern Baptist Convention. A pastor, who now pastors in Kentucky, came to the floor to do a motion to ask the Southern Baptist Convention to study the issue of abuse and provide some free curriculum to train our churches on how to handle these types of situations. Because the motion wasn't worded quite right, it got dismissed. It got sort of out of, because procedurally it wasn't quite what it needed to be. We can't instruct churches and we can't instruct entities from the floor of the Southern Baptist Convention. So it kind of gets pushed off to the side. But that's one of the earliest recognitions that as a body, we haven't dealt with this collectively and cooperatively, but we need to. And then just a few years later, after that, in 2007, another motion was brought to the floor of the Southern Baptist Convention to start a database that would be a sort of a collecting point for folks that had, you know, been fired from churches or been accused and convicted of practices of abuse in local churches. And this would be a place where we could put their names, if you will, so that it would protect other churches when they're hiring staff members and pastors. And then this gets referred out, and we come back and say, we can't do a database. We can't do a database for all sorts of reasons. But they came back and they made some encouraging, sort of encouraged churches to do the right thing, to do background checks and some other things. But largely, it sort of just gets dismissed. And this is 11 years ago, and it's just, And when this was being debated at the executive committee in 2007 and 2008, we had abuse survivors come and plead. And while maybe some platitudes were given in terms of all churches need to do this, there's no real teeth into the action steps. And so now we are in a position in a Me Too culture with someone who has sort of shined light on a number of incidences of sexual abuse and a number of incidents where it's been covered up, where we've got an issue in our hands that we've got to address. So, you know, that's sort of the recent history, if you will, sort of how we've thought about it as a body, how we tried to do something, maybe didn't do it as tenaciously as we ought to, and then we're now in this position where the covers have been pulled back and we really do need to address it.
You have described this as a systematic problem spanning decades of neglect in handling abuse cases in our local churches and through our cooperative structures. That sounds exactly like what you were describing just there. What kind of abuse then was falling through the cracks? What kind of, in some cases, not only misdeeds, but perhaps even crimes were being allowed to, if not continue, at least kind of be ignored? Congregations. Give us some examples, if you would.
Well, you know, a lot of these are abuse of sexual nature, sexual impropriety from an adult to a child. This is really where the spotlight is shining on those circumstances of abuse right now. That's where the most of the attention is at this present point. And what took place in a lot of cases is churches felt like they could handle it internally. They listened to the accused and listened to the accuser and tried to adjudicate what the truth was, or they listened and said, oh, yeah, something wrong happened, but we can help this person so that it doesn't happen again. And in some cases, what took place was people were dismissed from their ministry positions, but authorities weren't called, and those people then were allowed, because they didn't have a criminal background, abuse in their background, those folks were allowed then to move from church to church and to continue to serve, and because things were just getting swept under the rug. And, in some cases, unfortunately, sort of going back to the first point, victims or survivors just weren't believed. In that systemic problem, I lay out five things that I think sort of make up a systemic problem. I don't think it's one thing, and it's not systemic in that we have an authoritative structure that is fully aware of this and just can continue to sweep it under the rug. But we had some practices that kept us from dealing with it straightforwardly.
I want to get into those five things in a moment, but I'm curious because the kind of global scandal with the Roman Catholic Church has brought this to the attention of many people. And people say, look, the polity of the Roman Catholic Church has obviously been a major factor in their failure to address the abuse, this hierarchical structure that they have. Not bad in and of itself, but it's contributed. But the SBC's polity is almost the opposite. It's not just congregational. It's kind of a minimalist congregational view. I think someone has even said the Southern Baptist Convention only exists when they gather together in the convention.
Right.
Nonetheless, the SBC's policy, has its polity contributed in its own way?
Yeah, I think you can say in some ways yes. But, I mean, not explicitly. It's not created in such a way where this problem has a loophole. The reality is that predators look for places to hide. And predators can find places to hide in any social structures. They're looking for places to take advantage of people. They're looking for ways to gain credibility and place of standing so that they can have access to victims. And so while I say in some ways, yes, I mean, ours is a looser polity where there's not formal authority external to the church. And so that does create some ways for churches can operate on their own terms, if you will. They can decide what policies as a church that they're going to adhere to. There's some legal expectations and requirements that they have to live up to. But in terms of the SBC, we don't say everybody's going to have the very same protocol and what steps you follow here. You know, the other issue is when it comes to ordination, local churches hold ordination in the Southern Baptist Convention. And so that means that local churches have the responsibility to ordain ministers and give them standing or credentials to be a minister, and they continue to hold that. And if they're not being faithful to that responsibility over the lifetime of the minister, either making sure that they continue to hold accountability because they hold the ordination, or making sure that ordination is being transferred when they move from one church to the next so that that accountability can be held in proximity to where the minister's serving, then you lose a little bit of accountability structure. So our polity makes accountability more difficult. It doesn't mean we can't hold each other accountable. It just makes it a little bit more difficult. And so I think that's the one place our polity opens a door for predators to find a safe place, because that accountability structure is not as authoritarian or hierarchical, I guess is a better word.
Has it allowed predators, as you call them, to move from place to place with perhaps even a case of without any record of what they were doing in a previous congregation to follow them?
Yes, absolutely. And, and then when someone calls for a reference, we recognize and heard stories that sometimes those reference calls, you're not getting a full account of the previous work experience and getting a full account of the behavior of the person. And so sometimes I think that's out of naivety, not really understanding the behavior of one who is a predator and the danger that person presents. And then maybe sometimes out of just out of a legal fear that if I get in the way of that person's future and their opportunity to earn a living, then they could sue us. you know, if we say something negative. So, yeah, so I do think it has prevented us from being able to be as hold each other as faithfully accountable to what we hold together, just because it's just a looser structure.
Dr. Keith Whitfield is our guest. He's Associate Professor of Theology at Southeastern Baptist Theological Seminary, author of a column for First Things titled Sex Abuse Among Southern Baptists. When we come back, why was there a denial of the problem? Stay tuned.
We live in a perpetual revolution. The essence of our media's breathless headlines is not resistance to a particular regime or ruler, but a revolt against the very concept of civil order.
Aaron Wolf, executive editor of Chronicles Magazine, talking about his presentation at the Issues Etc. Making the Case conference.
We are now witness to the fact that civilization falls apart when its people abandon a shared belief in the permanent things, an enduring moral order established by God that exists outside of us.
You can meet and hear Aaron Wolf making the case for conservatism at our one and only 2019 Making the Case conference, Friday, June 7th and Saturday, June 8th in Chicago. Attendance is limited to 500. Find out more about the premier conference for Christian laity at issuesetc.org or give us a call 618-223-8385.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Memoria Press now offers 8 levels of the Simply Classical curriculum for children with special needs. These full-year packages help you teach reading, writing, arithmetic, art and music, poetry, science, history, Latin, classical and Christian studies in incremental and multisensory ways for mastery. Visit classicalspecialneeds.com and enter promo code LPR9 to save on resources for your home or school.
Do you dread going to work out? Performance Fitness in Edwardsville offers a fun, supportive, tight-knit community and environment. Visit them on the web at performancefitness618.com or call 618-692-5063. Performance Fitness is the facility in the St. Louis Metro East where the focus is on member results, not membership numbers. 618-692-5063 or performancefitness618.com. Performance Fitness of Edwardsville.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking about the Southern Baptist Convention's sexual abuse scandal. Dr. Keith Whitfield is our guest. We first told you about the 2019 Issues Etc. Making the Case conference just 3 weeks ago today. We already have more than 100 paid registrants for the one and only conference this year. Attendance is limited to 500. Early bird registration is $115. That includes 3 meals. Making the Case is Friday, June 7th and Saturday, June 8th in Chicago. Learn more about the premier conference for Christian laity and register at issuesetc.org or give us a call 618-223-8385. Dr. Whitfield, you had mentioned those 5 factors. Let's get into them one at a time, beginning with the denial of the problem. Why was there denial?
Well, I suggest 3 things. And interestingly enough, I told my wife this last week. I said, you know, when I wrote that article, I believe those 5 things were right, and what I said about those 5 things is right. And now after 2.5 or 3 weeks after the article has been published, and as a denomination, as a convention of churches, we've have navigated this thing, I'm more convinced that those 5 things are right. And the reasons that I think denial is there is, one of the things is we've wanted to protect the reputation of our churches, and that's a good thing. It comes from a good impulse. But the desire to protect the reputation of our churches, I think, has not always allowed us to see clearly how grave a problem is and the type of harm and threat it presents, and sometimes to sort of dismiss it a little bit, is not seeing it as big of a deal. I think that's one of the things. And on the flip side, I think there's been some folks that have a decent understanding of the problem, but they also see the enormity of dealing with it, and the challenges of facing it has sometimes led us not to be as active and decisive in dealing with it. And I think this is some of the what we see in our executive committee in particular. The executive committee is the group of folks who carry out the wishes of the convention when we're not meeting for the day and a half that we meet or 2 days that we meet. And so they carry out the wishes of the body of churches. And part of that is they help oversee our policies and who we are as a cooperative body. And one of those things is trying to vet or trying to determine whether a church is in freely cooperation with the Southern Baptist Convention. And they maybe have some understanding of what the problem is, but it was legally and polity-wise so complicated, they, I think at times, instead of being decisive, allowed those problems to be dealt with in a local context instead of making sure that they were being faithfully dealt with there, just sort of resigned the responsibility somewhere else. And I think the third reason of denial is, and I saw this shortly after the Houston Chronicle article came out, is just people start doing math. You know, if you take, you know, the examples they were giving in the report of the Houston Chronicles, and then you start looking at the statistics and start playing it out, then, you know, it's maybe this number of cases happening in our churches, and we have, you know, churches of, you know, like 15 million Southern Baptists, and then so it's less than 1%. And I just think it's not a math problem. You know, if we've got one, we need to deal with it. And the fact that we've got folks that have been perpetrators in one church and moved from other churches, and we've not decisively dealt with them, and we have survivors and of abuse in our churches, and they felt like they've been neglected for years and in some cases decades, not been listened to, it means we've got a problem we need to address. So I think those three things seem to me to contribute to this denial problem. And it's not one of them, it's a collective.
So explain how what you call the power dynamic in sexual abuse has been poorly understood in the SBC.
Yeah. So, you know, if we're going to understand abuse, we have to understand that it's somebody taking advantage of someone else. That this is not two consenting adults committing a sexual sin. This is someone who has influence and the opportunity to sort of exert their will on someone else who's vulnerable and is being taken advantage of. I think, and this has impacted us because then sometimes these things have been dismissed because they seem to be sexual deviant behavior, maybe just from the perpetrator, but it also could be the perpetrator and the victim. And because we haven't rightly understood that victims are sometimes in places where they're so vulnerable they have no recourse, and that the sin here is not just a sexual immoral act. The sin is someone has exerted their will over a vulnerable, helpless person for control. And I'm not trying to say one sin is bigger than the other necessarily. That's a conversation we could have. But it's a different type of thing. And because of that, it hasn't, I don't think in every case it's been dealt with in the appropriate way. So you could look at someone who is a predator and say, This is an act of sexual immorality. We can help you deal with sexual immorality, and you can seek forgiveness, and we can help you find a way of restoration. Now, this is a criminal act. It's an abusive act. You've sinned against a vulnerable person, and what we know from perpetrators like this is that they oftentimes move from one person that's vulnerable, one victim to another. So it's a different category of an act, and we've got to deal with it at that level. And so that's what I'm getting at in terms of not understanding the power dynamic of abuse and collapsing the category of abuse and sexual sin. We've got an example like this. We've got a church in Texas where there's a pastor currently serving who has a child with a girl that was in his church, and his story is it was an affair. Her story is it's abuse. His story, she was 16, 17, and consenting. Her story is, I was abused by my pastor. That's what we're at. That's what I'm trying to get at there.
What do you mean by a deficient doctrine of humanity as one of the factors for the sexual abuse scandal in the SBC?
Yeah, so, and this is tied to the one we just discussed in some ways. I think this gets at the level of empathy that we should have, and compassion, and I would say passion, and a sense of justice for the vulnerable and the survivor. And I think, you know, sometimes we have this sort of mind-body dualism thing that abuse is against the body. You know, sexual abuse or sexual sin is against the body. And I think we've been able to sort of compartmentalize that. And so we can ask someone who's been abused, a survivor, we can just ask them to forgive, to forget. Time will heal. And what we don't understand is, no, this is a violation against a human being, a whole person, mind and body, and that the offense is harmed them and has damaged them and has brought trauma to them. And so I think it's impacted the way that we have compassion and empathy to deal with the abused. And so what oftentimes happens is that people who are hurting often act like people who are hurting, and over time, we sort of get impatient with those folks. And one of the reasons for it is we don't understand the trauma that they've experienced and how deeply wounded they are, and how the recovery process for them isn't just an act of forgiveness. It's not just time's going to heal it. Is that we're complicated human beings and we're complicated people, and when an offense like abuse is taking place, there's no sense in which it's non-injurious. You know, it injures the body, it injures the mind, and it creates a sense of fear and anxiety and depression in people's lives that sometimes they never get over. We've not always understood that well. And I think it means that because of that, we've not treated people with the sort of empathy that we ought to.
You say another factor is simply arrogance. How have individuals, congregations, denominational leaders acted arrogantly in many of these cases?
Yeah, so what I'm getting at there is it's the idea that we can handle it in ourselves. You know, we can close the door, we can work through the situation with both parties, and the reality is that, number one, that when a crime happens, we should call the police. And second, that these things are complicated and difficult scenarios, and pastors and church leaders are not oftentimes equipped to be the sole people caring and helping to navigate a body of people, a church, through the situation. They're not oftentimes equipped to be able to discern who's telling the truth and who's not telling the truth. Not oftentimes able to discern what a survivor needs in terms of care. And because we felt like we can handle it ourselves, and you hear stories about this, there's a church that's listed in the Houston Chronicle article and the Southern Baptist Church, and part of their story is that they brought survivor in the room with the one who abused them and asked them to forgive them, and has tried to deal with things in the church. In part, I think, is to protect the reputation of the church, but also just the sort of arrogance that the pastor who is trained to know God's word and understands the gospel and has a sense of training in terms of pastoral care. But this issue probably goes beyond the pastor's training. And that sometimes I think even the relationships that are entangled in some of these things and being able to separate and listen and understand what's happening and discern and figure out who's telling the truth. Sometimes we need a third party to help us navigate these things. So that's what I'm getting at. And I think it is an act of arrogance, just a sense of pride. I don't think anybody set out to be arrogant, but just a sense of pride that you can handle these things and just not recognizing how big of an issue they are.
We're talking about the Southern Baptist Convention's sexual abuse scandal. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. Dr. Keith Whitfield is our guest, Associate Professor of Theology, Dean of Graduate Studies, and Vice President for Academic Administration at Southeastern Baptist Theological Seminary in Wake Forest, North Carolina. He's authored a recent column for First Things titled Sex Abuse Among Southern Baptists. When we come back, we'll turn from the subject of arrogance to the false fronts and convenient excuses he cites as one of the factors in this abuse and its cover-up. Also, he's calling for a moral resurgence in the Southern Baptist Convention. What would that look like? Stay tuned.
Solid, serious, substantive. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Hey, Todd, what have our listeners noticed first when visiting the LPR studios?
Definitely the small size and the dirt.
Well, not anymore. Thanks to our friends at the Cleaning Authority, they've turned this man cave into a space that meets even our wives' approval.
Whether it's our office or your home, the Cleaning Authority is your cleaning service provider in the St. Louis area.
To schedule a free estimate or to find out more, visit thecleaningauthority.com. Thecleaningauthority.com.
College Preparation Station in Maryville, Illinois offers ACT, SAT, and PSAT test prep, scholarship application classes, college and career counseling, and more. Hi, this is Lori Konski, president of College Preparation Station. We have helped our students obtain more than $7 million in tuition scholarships in 12 years. Find out more at cpsprep.com. Let us help you create a vision and find your future. The College Preparation Station in Maryville, Illinois, cpsprep.com.
Listen to the best of the church's music for the season of Lent at LutheranPublicRadio.org. Sacred music for the season of Lent, LutheranPublicRadio.org.
Good Shepherd Lutheran Church in Collinsville, Illinois is happy to support the Christ-centered, cross-focused ministry of Issues Etc. Join us for worship, Bible classes, youth ministry, and other opportunities to grow in Christ. We have a Christian day school for children in preschool to eighth grade. We are located at 1300 Beltline Road. Call us at 618-344-3151 or visit www.goodshepherdcollinsville.org.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking about the Southern Baptist Convention's sexual abuse scandal with Dr. Keith Whitfield. He's Associate Professor of Theology, Dean of Graduate Studies, and Vice President for Academic Administration at Southeastern Baptist Theological Seminary in Wake Forest, North Carolina, and he's authored a recent column for First Things titled Sex Abuse Among Southern Baptists. Dr. Whitfield, you talk about false fronts and convenient excuses when it comes to both the abuse and the failure to address the problem in the Southern Baptist Convention. Give us some examples.
Yeah, the one I'm appealing to in particular in the article is the appeal to autonomy. That because, you know, we're a convention of churches with autonomous churches, as a body of churches, as a Southern Baptist Convention, there are just not a whole lot we can do. Things like we can't have a registry because that would violate a church's autonomy to require a church to do something like that, or, you know, some other solutions that came along the way. And my contention is, and I don't have all the answers here, and I'm certainly willing to throw my ideas out there, my contention is that autonomy should not be a hindrance. Autonomy is actually something that really gives us the freedom to cooperate. And whenever you cooperate with someone else, you commit yourself to them, and that means that you have to live up to certain levels of commitment. And so you can say you're kind of giving up some of your autonomy even in that act, but you're freely doing that. And I think as a body of churches, we can decide that there are certain things, which we already do. I mean, there's certain expectations. If you're going to be a Southern Baptist church, there's certain things you have to do. There's certain things you can't do. And so we already do this. So I think there's no reason in the situation of handling sexual abuse that we can't do it as well. So I just think it's been, it's complicated. I don't dismiss that, but it's been an easy sort of excuse of not being able to be decisive on dealing with these things, these types of situations. And so that's what I'm getting at. And I just don't buy that autonomy stands in the way of us joining together to really figure out a way to address this. And my thoughts, the language I've used in conversation and in another article is that we need to leverage our autonomy. Let's use an asset that we have to join together, to covenant together, to protect the vulnerable. And my thoughts are, it's not one solution. There's multiple solutions. And the reality is, every solution will have a weakness. But if we can have multiple good solutions that we can apply and work together and commit to each other on them, then what we can do is, I think we can limit the risk. We can practice best practices in terms of reporting and responding when something happens, and do a good job of faithfully caring for survivors who have been abused. So those are my ideas, but I just don't think autonomy should be something we hide behind. I think we should embrace who we are and figure out how to use it.
You're calling for what you call a moral resurgence in the SBC. What would that look like?
You know, for me, it would look like this. It would say that we would look at each other and say, whatever it takes. Whatever it takes for us to join together to make sure that survivors in our churches feel cared for, whatever it takes for us to make sure that we send a message that predators do not have a safe place in our churches, and just a moral gravity and a moral center to that on this issue, and what I believe is, if we do it on this issue, it'll have an impact on other issues. But on this issue, we're not going to let legal concerns keep us from doing whatever it takes. We're not going to let financial concerns keep us from doing whatever it takes. Administrative concerns, we're going to do whatever it takes to make sure that we send a message to protect the vulnerable, to show empathy and our own brokenheartedness towards the brokenhearted, that we fight for justice and righteousness. And so that's for me what the moral resurgence would look like here, that we take what we believe about the scriptures and we apply it to the moral moment of our day and our moral opportunity. You know, and I think this is Southern Baptist moral opportunity. It's not that I think that these types of situations don't happen to other family of churches. I just think God has providentially allowed us to see a problem and has called us to respond to it. And so the moral resurgence right now is for us to step up to the moral opportunity to do whatever it takes. And then what I believe is that will have an impact on the conscience and the culture of our churches and other areas. Wherever we live our lives in a conformity to the gospel, we live one aspect of our lives in conformity to the gospel. It has impact on other aspects of our lives. You know, and so I think anytime as a body of churches we have sort of a moral resolve to do the right thing, it's going to have an impact on other aspects of our church life.
As you have pointed out, the sexual abuse failure to address that problem are not unique to the Roman Catholic Church or the Southern Baptist communions. What would you say to a Lutheran, that's my particular profession of faith, who says, look, this couldn't happen to us?
What I would say is, what we started off with, that predators find soft places. They find places to hide. They find structures to manipulate. They look for vulnerable people, and they're good at it. And there's no perfect structure. There's no perfect polity. If we're going to talk about churches, if we're not talking about churches, other social structures, there's no perfect structure. There are soft places. And I think we have to be critical about our polity and where those soft places might be and figure out how to address them. And then there's some common things that we all can do. You know, we can all abide by the laws of the land and the expectations on reporting and best practices. And you know, there's some things that we can learn from each other in terms of caring for survivors. And so that my encouragement would be to first recognize that we all have soft places. It's just the reality of social structures and groups of people. You can be critical about those, and you probably already have some awareness of what those might be. By critical, I just mean thinking critically about them, and you already have some awareness of them. And identify those things and figure out ways to create accountability and some checks in those places so that people can't persist there long term. And so Southern Baptists have our unique ones, and I hope we can address those. And your polity has some unique opportunities that way too, and I would just encourage you to look at them.
Where does the Southern Baptist Convention go from here after not only the actual events, but the exposure in that recent Houston Chronicle article? Where does it go?
Yeah, so it's a great question. Our president has taken an unprecedented, courageous leadership step to lay out 10 things for us to pursue, and those things, I think, are good, positive steps in the right direction in terms of adopting some curriculum, both at the local church level, but also in our seminaries as we train men and women who are going to be serving in local churches. So he's taken some really big, bold steps. He also took a very unprecedented step for the president to say there's some churches in our convention that were listed in this article. We should look at those churches, and we should approach them and find out what their policies are. This would be a good place for us to start. So I think the work he's doing, we're already seeing fruits of it. Another thing he did, he laid out some principles, some best practices, principles that he asked our state conventions to adopt, our seminaries to adopt. Our local Baptist associations are adopting principles like that too. And so he's just trying to get us all to sort of throw our chips in to say we'll work on this together. You know, some other things that he's mentioned that he's still working to think about the best way to do it is as a registry and some things like that would be very practical. My hope is that we don't, and I believe we will this time, that we won't just have platitudes and convictional statements, that we will follow it up with action steps. And my prayer is that those action steps will have an impact on our culture as a body of churches. I pray that it'll help us be a people who are brokenhearted over those that are abused and brokenhearted, and that we see the responsibility to care for these folks. And we are places where it's a safe place for families to come into our churches. You know, and I think that to the whatever extent there has been that our pride from a storied history to be the largest convention or denomination in North America, our storied history of a conservative resurgence, whatever pride that's been part of our conscience because of those things, which we're all thankful for, but you know, pride is not a healthy thing for us to live with. But whatever pride has come with that, this would humble us, and we'd work together to provide safe places for families, to care for brokenhearted people, proclaim the gospel faithfully, and the Lord would help us to give us opportunities to minister to people and see people come to faith in Christ, and that we would see something of a renewal and a revival among our churches because of it. And I think as a body of churches, and I think we are in a transformational moment. And I think as a body of churches, maybe we're in a transformational moment that we're willing to be a whatever it takes kind of people instead of a people that protects the convention and the reputation of our churches for legal reasons, but we'd be for whatever it takes.
Dr. Keith Whitfield is Associate Professor of Theology, Dean of Graduate Studies, and Vice President for Academic Administration at Southeastern Baptist Theological Seminary in Wake Forest, North Carolina. He's author of a recent column for First Things titled Sex Abuse Among Southern Baptists. You can read it at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Listen on Demand. Dr. Whitfield, thank you very much.
Thank you. Appreciate the time.
We will take up the subject of the incarnation and the season of Lent that begins Wednesday this week with Pastor Jeff Hemmer right after the break.
Mark your calendars for the Scott Credit Union Metro East Home and Garden Show, March 16th and 17th, at and to benefit Metro East Lutheran High School in Edwardsville. The Home and Garden Show is a fundraiser produced by a volunteer parents group with the support of regional businesses and partners. The Metro East Home and Garden Show has something for everyone, from the basement to the roof and everything in between, to gardening, lawn care, and landscaping outside your home. From Fred Bird and fabulous prizes, including a flock of Cardinal tickets, to pre-game field passes, and the opportunity to throw out the first pitch at a Cardinal game this season, courtesy of Seavers Equipment, registration required. And remember, pulled pork, potato salad, and more for sale all weekend long. Show admission, parking are free, courtesy of Element Turf. The Scott Credit Union Metro East Home and Garden Show, March 16th and 17th, is sponsored in part by Liberty Fence, Renown Remodeling, Seavers Equipment, and Woods Basement Systems. Show and exhibitor details can be found at mehgs.org.
Listen to what you want, when you want. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
An average of 20 military veterans kill themselves every day. Project Operation Barnabas is a network of LCMS congregations who reach out to veterans and their congregations and their communities with the gospel of Jesus Christ. Operation Barnabas is a program of LCMS Ministry to the Armed Forces. Find out more at lcms.org/armed forces. Serving those who serve. LCMS Ministry to the Armed Forces. lcms.org/armed forces.
Remember when education was about the fundamental skills of reading, writing, and arithmetic? And about reading great literature and studying history to give our kids a model for what it is to be a good person? Memoria Press's Classical Christian Curriculum offers that very model for your homeschool. Get $5 off your next order by using the coupon code LPR9. For more information, go to memoriapress.com. Memoria Press. Saving Western civilization, one student at a time.